It's August 30th, and you're listening to the Humanist Network News, an audio production by the Institute for Humanist Studies. I'm your host, Jess Constantine.
And I'm your host, Duncan Crary. On today's show, we're going to speak to Brenda Fry, an atheist who spent 1 month living with an evangelical Christian family for the reality TV show 30 Days. We're also going to speak with Margaret Downey, the brand new president of the Atheist Alliance International, and she's going to answer the million-dollar question for us today, which is why does the Atheist Alliance International and the American Atheist host their annual conference on the same day? In the second half of the program, we have a special presentation by the International Humanist and Ethical Youth Organization.
In case folks are out there joining us for the first time, humanism is a non-religious philosophy based on reason and compassion.
And while we're talking about compassion, you all know that yesterday was the one-year anniversary of Hurricane Katrina that left more than 1,800 people dead and 500,000 people displaced from their homes in the Gulf region. It was around this time last year that Americans and people from all over the world responded to the devastation with an outpouring of compassion for the victims. Humanists have a saying, in times of crisis, it's deeds, not creeds, that count.
That's right. And speaking of good deeds, there were some free thought groups that collected aid money for Katrina victims, such as the American Humanist Association, the Atheist Alliance International, the Center for Inquiry, and the Universalist Movement.
As you all know, the city of New Orleans was the hardest hit by Katrina. Last year, the Humanist Network News E-Zine obtained some firsthand reports of the disaster from members of the New Orleans Secular Humanist Association. At the time that we checked in, there were only 40 out of the 300 people on the NOSHA mailing list who had confirmed with members of the group that they were okay. I did get a chance to speak with Michael Malik, a member of the New Orleans Secular Humanist Association, 2 weeks ago when he stopped by the H&N headquarters in Albany, New York for an interview. Here's what he had to say. Michael, the last time that we wrote about the New Orleans Secular Humanist Association was right after Hurricane Katrina. And some of your members, at the time, I think 40 of the 200 members had checked in and said they were okay. How did things fare down there? How you doing?
Well, most people were pretty scattered because most everyone who had a credit card in a car left New Orleans. I myself did. I was up here in New York for 4 months, mm-hmm. and I've been back down there since. As far as we know, we didn't actually lose any members. No one died, but mm-hmm. we have since lost a lot of members to other cities. They're living places, and we don't know whether they'll come back or not. Mm-hmm. But we maintain email with a lot of people right. who are now in Nashville or wherever. Mm-hmm. And a number have come back, and we're back to having our meetings, but they're only monthly instead of twice a month now.
Yeah. Now, your president, Harry Greenberger, right?
Yes.
He had a terrifying experience. He was airlifted off his roof. Is that right?
Yes. Harry lived in Lakeview. To give you an idea, the neighborhood I live in, my elevation, flood map elevation, is plus 4.5 feet. Mm-hmm. Harry's house, his elevation was minus 10.5 feet. Mm-hmm. It was a one-story house. He was airlifted by the Coast Guard off of his roof.
Mm-hmm. And he's okay now, though?
He's fine, yes. Yeah. He's rented an apartment in the warehouse district, so he is back in New Orleans, which is mostly condos.
Great. So. Now, what is your organization doing anything to help, in the aftermath of Katrina? Have they been volunteering? And
we plan to do more. Uh-huh. We did one thing. There was a humanist group, and they uh-huh. sent us a check for a chunk of money that they collected, and they said that they would like to do something with that money. And what they suggested was that we find a college-bound high school student who was a non-believer mm-hmm. And buy and give them a laptop.
Yeah.
From NOSHA, from us, and from
this other group.
And we did that. Mm-hmm. We found a college-bound non-believer, and we gave him a laptop, and we had a nice little press conference.
So excellent. Excellent.
It worked out well. And we had other offers of help mm-hmm. from other groups around the country. We right. appreciated very much the emails and phone calls that mostly came through Harry that we got from organizations around the country. Mm-hmm. It was great.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And how's the city looking? Is it?
It depends on where you are.
Yeah.
The French Quarter, the neighborhood I live in, which is called Faubourg Marigny, which is just downriver from the French Quarter, parts of Uptown, what we refer to these days as the sliver by the river, mm-hmm. the high ground, mm-hmm. is almost back to normal, except going out to restaurants, they don't stay open beyond 6 or 7 o'clock because they don't have employees.
Right.
But when you get into, and I do photography amongst other things, and I go into the Lower Ninth about once a month mm-hmm. to see what's happened. And pretty much the only improvement I've seen down there in the last 5 months is when the city demolished the houses that were actually sitting across streets. So you can now drive down every street in the Lower Ninth because they've demolished the houses that were blocking streets. Mm-hmm. The houses that weren't blocking streets look just the same.
Yeah.
They're still sitting on top of a truck and a boat on top of the house. Mm-hmm. Everything is still the same. Nothing has changed. And we largely blame FEMA for a lot of that.
Yeah.
There were a lot of promises, most of which haven't been fulfilled.
Yeah. Now, are you concerned? There's been a lot of talk of condominium developers coming in and pretty much making it impossible for a lot of the original residents who were black and African American to move back. Is that a concern? Is that a realistic concern?
That is definitely a realistic concern. Uh-huh. New Orleans is 65+% black.
Yeah.
Our estimates are now it's perhaps 50-50. Mm-hmm. We had a population of 450,000, and they're estimating now a daytime population of around 200 and a nighttime population of 150 or mm-hmm. so. Mm-hmm. The areas that I mentioned, that sliver by the river, the oldest parts of town are also the most desirable, the historic districts, mm-hmm. and they are a much higher percentage white.
Yeah.
Of the areas that were lost to flooding, the only area that was predominantly white was Lakeview. And that will come back, but the Lower Ninth, which is predominantly black, and New Orleans East, which is predominantly black, there's been almost nothing on rebuilding.
Yeah.
There are a lot of people who would like to come back. McDonald's is paying a $250 for part-timers and $500 for full-timers signing bonus and paying $11 an hour.
Yeah, wow.
When all those jobs were minimum wage. But there is plenty of work, but no place to live.
Yeah.
And that's the major problem. We also have the work that is getting done seems to be largely getting done by Mexicans who have come in, and we don't know where they sleep at night, except our local newspaper has found that some sleep in abandoned buildings. They're hard to interview because our reporters aren't used to speaking Spanish. We didn't have much of a Spanish community before. But, every morning around Lee Circle, which is in the middle of town, there's hundreds of men, mostly Hispanic, standing around, and the pickup trucks come by and they point, yeah, you, and those guys hop in the back of the truck and they go off. It's all day labor.
None of the water, never set in sun. You're dreaming with me, so we will melt as one. Digging in our
That was Michael Malik, a member of the New Orleans Secular Humanist Association. You can learn more about NOSHA on the web by visiting www.nosha.secularhumanism.net. I also spoke to Michael about his work with the ACLU in Louisiana, and I'll be airing a section of that interview in a later podcast.
So we forgot to mention, Duncan, that last show I announced that we'd be able to sort of skip through chapters and segments of a podcast.
I recall.
Yep. Well, we're going to have to ask folks to sort of bear with us for a moment because we were experiencing some technical difficulties that sort of made that not possible. We realized that we have to sort of put out another podcast in addition to the one that's already happening. So soon.
Just stay tuned.
Yeah, stay tuned.
So what's next?
All right. Up next, we have an interview with Brenda Fry, who is an atheist that recently appeared on the FX television show called 30 Days, and that was created by Morgan Spurlock.
He's the guy from Super Size Me documentary, right?
That's right. So 30 Days, it's like a reality TV show where people are supposed to walk in someone else's shoes for 30 days. Mm. And Brenda, she's an atheist homemaker from Lawrence, Kansas. And she lived with Michael and Tracy Shores for 30 days. And the Shores are this evangelical Christian family living in Frisco, Texas.
Right. From Kansas to Texas.
That's right. From Kansas to Texas. She followed Dorothy's footsteps, I guess. So the show first aired on FX on August 9th. And it's been repeated three or four times. But there's been an estimated viewership of 566,000, which is mm-hmm. pretty good, I think.
Mm-hmm.
So Matt Cherry, our executive director here at the Institute for Humanist Studies, and I, we recently spoke to Brenda by phone. So here we go with that.
Tonight on 30 Days, an atheist moves in with a family of Christians.
I always ask people that get so anti-Christian.
If they don't believe in God, they're not against it.
Will it be heaven on earth as they learn to see the world through each other's eyes?
I don't think that all of our morals just come from the Bible.
Or will all hell break loose?
I think that is 100% wrong.
As diametrically opposing belief systems collide.
We really don't know what you believe. We know what you don't believe.
Love and hope and peace and...
Yeah, that's what I mean.
Find out tonight on 30 Days.
So tell us how you got involved with the show 30 Days.
Okay. We saw a casting call that was sent out through an email through the Freedom From Religion Foundation. And they were looking for an atheist family to be on this reality documentary.
And what made you decide that you would put yourself through this?
One of the reasons we wanted to do this was because we wanted to help dispel the unfair and negative stereotypes about atheists. And also, we were hoping that we could try to provide some understanding for others into why we and many other people are atheists.
Well, I have to say that in our opinion, you did a fantastic job of that. I actually watched the show with Margaret Downey, who's the new president of the Atheist Alliance International. Uh-huh. We both felt we could not have imagined a better person to dispel no. these stereotypes because atheists tend to be viewed as angry and bitter and as very far from the mainstream of American life. And you came across as very friendly and normal and a sort of typical middle American, if I can say so. And we felt that this was a great way of showing that the typical friendly neighborhood atheist who's just like you but doesn't go to church.
Right. Well, thank you. I'm sure there are a lot of atheists and humanists out there that could have done a better job than I did or we did. But, all I can say is we tried our best, and in many ways we are just like our neighbors and pretty normal, typical people. And, pretty much that's describes atheists, I think, in general.
That was sort of the point, it seemed.
Right.
So what did you learn from the show, from being on there? What was your experience like?
Well, someone did ask me if I learned anything if anything changed my views on being an atheist, and it didn't at all. I didn't question my thinking about being an atheist. I learned a lot about TV and producers, and
right.
That was actually the most frustrating part for me, is dealing with some of the producers.
Can you tell us what you found frustrating
yeah.
about that?
Yeah. For instance, on about day two that I was there, when, as you see in the show, I say something about the money for these mega churches could have been used a better way or a different way, and... afterwards, the field producer, kind of got on me and told me how I was ruining the relationship already and basically that I needed to back off. And so then there were really mixed messages throughout the entire time. It was either I'm not talking enough, or I'm talking too much, or I'm asking too many questions. And I remember one time I was having an interview really with one of the ministers, and the field producer just stopped and butt right in and said, "You just sound like you're Diane Sawyer, and you're just asking all these questions." I thought when you ask a lot of questions, you get people to kind of see where they're going backwards in their own thinking and talking without having to point it out directly. So I don't know.
I mean, obviously, it's an hour-long show, and you were there for the 30 days of the title, so they must have cut out a huge amount of stuff. But
right. My guess is that they took about 300 hours to 400 hours altogether of taping, of video. And
wow,
from that, a 45-minute show, which I'm not on there the entire time either. And so there's a huge amount that wasn't on there. In fact, it was very frustrating to me when I first saw the got a copy of the show, and I was quite upset because I didn't feel like they used any of the footage from the deeper discussions about more ideological issues, such as original sin and salvation and so forth. And I really did press the producers about this, and they eventually indicated that one of the reasons they didn't use some of this is because they were subject to the more conservative aspects of the parent network, which was Fox.
That's interesting.
So, yes, and so, you know, I really hope that whether it's by Morgan or somebody else in the future, that they'll go ahead and take that risk and go further in depth into more issues.
Well, obviously, we don't know what they cut out, but from what we saw, and we watched it here at the office and with other people, we felt it was a very, if I can use a Fox term, a very fair and balanced presentation of the atheist viewpoint, because they could have done a real hatchet job on you if they only showed about, you know, 5% of what they recorded. But in fact, you came across very well. And we felt Tracy, the host wife, came across very well. But that Mike, the husband, was the person who came across the worst out of everyone they showed. And he seemed to be very...
Thick.
Deliberately obtuse. I mean, he kept asking you questions and then refused to listen to your answers.
Right. And actually, your choice of words, Jessica, rhymes with the word that I've been reading on the blogs about him. Right. One of the things that bothered Michael was the most was that he could not understand how people can live a valuable life and one that cares about the betterment of the world without having God or the Bible as a script for living. And it really seemed to surprise them that non-religious people can raise responsible, respectful children and have positive, contributing lives. And even Tracy said something about, well, I saw her mother instincts kick in. And, you know, what was she expecting, you know?
Right.
I felt he wasn't just surprised, but he was threatened by the idea that you could be a good parent without religion. It seemed to be something he didn't want to hear.
I think that, well, Michael had told me that he would have been in jail if it wasn't for God. And so this is very foreign to him to think that people are just responsible for their behavior on their own and that we are not just attributing our behavior to something else, but to ourselves. And obviously, he didn't do that. He said that God was his conscience, and so he's not really psychologically aware of what goes on in his own behavior, I think.
It's scary.
I would like to say something about Tracy and some things that were not shown. And overall, Tracy was shown to be fairly compassionate and understanding throughout the entire episode. But In actuality, I must tell you that when I first arrived, Tracy was witnessing very assertively to me and really reading the Bible in my face and basically saying, you know, I needed to make a change. And so, in fact, it was a surprise for me to hear just a week or so later when she said that she was willing to agree to disagree. And on the show, you can actually see a little hesitation on my part to accept that from her, because I was thinking that this is really different from how she had been coming across the first week or two. So there really was a big change on her part, and this would have been an extremely valuable point to show. And my husband and I both described it in the same word. It was really a softening on her part, and she really backed down. So in the beginning, there was this push that I needed to read all these books and I needed to convert to Christianity. But by the end, she told me in a kind manner, she said, if you don't want those books, you can give them to your Christian friends. So I thought that was, she had really come a long ways. And but even with regard to that, there's also some interesting post-show news. Tracy and I had a heart-to-heart talk about our thoughts on the edited show just a few days before it aired nationally. And here I'm thinking, well, she looked pretty good and pretty nice and tolerant on this edited show. And but it's interesting that she felt badly that other Christians might think that she didn't quote the Bible enough or she didn't try hard enough to witness to me.
Oh, she didn't appear judgmental enough. That's quite right. Funny, because we thought she came across as much friendlier than her husband did. So it's interesting that she was worried she was too friendly.
She wasn't trying to convert you enough.
Exactly. And in fact, she even shared that she had some discomfort and really dissonance over having said that we, my family, were, quote, good people. And then she quoted to me some scripture over the phone, and that said something like, you must have God to be good. And I just thought that's really sad that here she was, you know, she holds to a book that is precluding her from having these warm, loving thoughts about other people. And so, you know, she's really still working on this issue and struggling with it.
Help me remember how to hold on to my belief. Every time I touch your skin, every time I breathe you in, you take me on back to church again. It feels like a Sunday every time I look in your eyes, and every time you're kissing me goodbye, you make me feel like I just been baptized.
We're listening to an interview with Brenda Fry, an atheist homemaker from Kansas, who recently appeared on the reality television show 30 Days on FX. Brenda lived for 30 days with an evangelical Christian family, Michael and Tracy Shores, in their Texas home. My co-host, Jess Constantine, and Matt Cherry, executive director of the Institute for Humanist Studies, spoke to Brenda by phone last Thursday. Jess, in the interview, you were just talking about how Michael, the husband host on 30 Days, was a little bit slow, maybe, when it comes to understanding and respecting atheism. I think you pulled a couple clips from the show to demonstrate this.
That's right, Duncan. We've got an audio clip from the show where Brenda took her host family to meet with the members of the North Texas Church of Freethought. So this is a sort of conversation that that the members of that church had with Michael.
Does the government have a legitimate right to make a theological statement for everybody?
Well, we don't really care.
Would you care if it said on your dollar bills and on your coins, there is no God?
No. Our says in God we trust, and we actually like that.
What would you think if it said there is no God?
It says in God we trust.
What if it said there is no God?
It says in God we trust.
I'm asking you a hypothetical. What would you think of that?
I live here in the U.S., and it says in God we trust.
For the record, I would oppose putting there is no God on our money, because I respect the right of Christians and other believers to have their beliefs without having to carry around money that has something on it, a slogan with which they really deeply disagree. I'm willing to let you guys have your religious liberty, but you're not willing to let me have mine.
I guess it doesn't bother me that it's on the money. If it bothers you, move. I mean,
you see, this is a typical Christian, it's a Christian country. If you don't like it, then get out. That's terrible.
P.S. Just before that, a couple seconds prior to this conversation, Michael had recently said this about treating all people sort of equally and fairly.
The fundamental basis of Christianity is love your neighbor as yourself.
Right.
It did not say love your Christian neighbor as yourself.
That sounds a little bit hypocritical.
Yeah.
All right. In the second part of the interview, Jess and Matt are going to speak to Brenda about some of the behind the scenes goings on at the reality show.
That's right. So let's go on with the interview.
I noticed that when you went to the church and the prayer group, it obviously it looks like you're just going there privately and it's intimate, but obviously you're going there with the film crew and they know all about what's going on. And it seemed like people were really trying to convert you, because normally if you go to a Christian church, they don't have to give a whole sermon on the importance of embracing Christianity. Did you feel that there was a real effort there to try and pressure you to become a Christian, or just normal witnessing, or how would you describe that?
Well, it was clear to me from the people in the group that it was not okay for me not to believe in God. And in fact, even by the end, the leader is still praying that he hopes I come around and see the light or something like that, come back to Christ or something like that. And so there certainly was some of that witnessing and pressuring going on, and that's what their Bible, their book tells them that they need to do. So they're trying to do what they think is the right thing.
They didn't really show you interacting with the children very much, or indeed when your children came, they didn't show the two sets of kids talking with each other. And I wondered if there was much of that off camera and how that went. What was the reaction of the children in the family mm-hmm. who had this atheist mm-hmm. in their midst?
Uh-huh. Well, it was fairly quick in terms of with all the children there, because we had this packed weekend. When my family came in, we were taken to this Christian rock concert. And so that didn't leave a lot of time for discussion between the children. And then we also went to the aquarium, and none of that was shown, but we had several hours of debate, Mark and Michael specifically, on evolution, and none of that was used. But the oldest, their oldest daughter, she's a stepdaughter, and she was in and out, so I did not see her all the time. I did go to her Christian school, and I guess there wasn't a lot of remarkable things going on there, and they didn't show in some mm-hmm. sense, and they didn't show any of that. But I would like to talk about the evolution issue when that came up. I want to apologize for coming across very weak, I thought, and I think criticism of me in that regard is well-founded. In my defense, I would like to explain a couple of things, the few reasons why I was caught off guard. I had already talked about my thoughts earlier about how I think it's okay to question science and question evolution, and as that's what motivates us to learn. And I had said on film that we don't need to deal with our anxiety about not knowing something by slapping a one-word answer on it, like God. Mm-hmm. And I'd also raised the question about what's next. You know, are we going to be teaching women that women come from men's rib in biology class? But none of that part was used. I did want to say something about the golden rule, too, that really bugged me. The field producer asked me specifically, well, do you follow the golden rule? And I thought, well, yes, but those wouldn't be necessarily the words that I would choose to describe my beliefs in life. But then she says, well, say that. And so I said, well, okay, try to follow the golden rule. And then she says, well, what is the golden rule? Say it, you know. And I knew that I could back up some information about it, and I explained both to Michael and Tracy that the Golden Rule comes from pre-Christian times and Confucius and the Zoroastrians, even 1500 BC. And Michael just dismissed this very quickly, and he did bring it up again in a sarcastic manner later. So I think it stuck with him a little bit. But unfortunately, none of that part of the footage was shown. And I think a lot of people will jump to the conclusion that, she really does rely on the Bible for her ethical living and so forth. And, you know, that's just not the case. And so, anyway, I think that was a little misleading.
I wanted to ask you the impact on your sort of family and neighbors and you know, how are you perceived by your friends after this TV appearance?
Uh-huh. Actually, I was very surprised how positive the reaction has been. I was expecting that people to be much more upset. I have gotten a couple of rude stares at the stores, but for the most part, I have had people that I barely know come up to me, even religious people, and they've given me high fives in the store. And I had one lady, a Christian woman, who called and said that she got together with her neighbors to watch it and how she thought it was great, and that she started to have dialogue about some of these issues with her diverse neighbors. So I think that's just really important, and you know, I think Morgan Spurlock should feel pleased and that this project is a success when you hear things like that.
All right, one more question, Brenda. How did your house look when you got home?
Actually, very well. My husband, I must say, much credit goes to him, Mark, and he took great care of the kids and was working on his job, and he was dealing with my frantic, crazy calls home. And so, you know, much credit goes to him and to the kids that I'm very proud of. So,
thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
And thank you for doing such a wonderful job representing the free thought community. I think you are a tremendous representative. And the reactions you got from religious as well as non-religious people show that you really did manage to change some stereotypes people have about us.
Well, good. I hope that it's a step forward for us, and you know, I think that this is somewhat groundbreaking for this topic to be treated in this manner, but you know, we need to gain acceptance as a group and decrease some of this prejudice, and you know, it might make the choice of becoming a free thinker a more viable option for other people then.
And it was Jane who spoke. She said, "It's true, your cousin's not a Christian. But we love trees, we love the snow, the friends we have, the world we share. And you find magic from your God, and we find magic everywhere." So the Christians and the pagans sit together at the table, finding faith and common ground, the best that they were able. Now where does magic come from? I think magic's in the learning. 'Cause now when Christians sit with pagans, only pumpkin pies are burning.
Awesome interview, Jess. Awesome. But there was one clip from the show that you pulled that you didn't get to use in your interview.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
I'm familiar with this one.
Yeah, set the stage. What is this again? What happened?
This was that Brenda went to Bible study with her host family, and you know, they got into some pretty heated discussions about their beliefs.
And right, and this is what one of the people said as Brenda was leaving, right?
Yep.
Oh, man. Let's see that one. I don't know if I heard that right the first time. Oh, dude, so you asked Brenda about this, and what did she say? She said it wasn't a big deal, right?
Right. She said that she didn't think that they ran it in the way of I'm glad that I'm not atheist.
Yeah, right. Yeah, well, okay. Yeah, we'll see.
It was nice of Brenda.
So I asked a couple follow-up questions of Brenda really quickly because I'm so nosy. Yes, she was compensated for being on the show, but it wasn't a lot of money. And she is currently going through a little post-traumatic stress disorder, basically, from having a camera stuck in her face, you know, all day long for a month. So just to know how she feels. And yes, some of the scenes were posed, like brushing her teeth and stuff in the morning, but most of it was legit. So Jess, if people want to watch the show, where else can they catch it?
Well, the show is supposed to be repeated a couple more times on FX. So that's season 2, and this is episode 3. Mm-hmm. It's also going to be available on DVD probably in a few months after the season ends.
And you can get it on iTunes too, right?
That's right. You can download each show for 99 cents, or you can download the whole season for $6.
Cool. If you want to see Brenda in person, you just missed her in Kansas City, but she is going to be presenting in Las Vegas this November talking about her experiences. So next up, we have some listener comments.
Hi, this is Maureen Matsumura, Berkeley, California, USA. Also known as Sweet Reason in the Humanist Network News e-zine. This call is coming in a little late, but I was catching up on the podcast, and I loved the segment on comic book heroes and their beliefs. And I thought anyone else who loved that segment or loves comic books or is just curious might want to read the novel The Amazing Adventures of Cavalier and Clay by Michael Chabon. It won a Pulitzer Prize and is based on history of the comic book industry with plenty of fascinating fantasy mixed in. It's a novel, after all. And besides, I'm very starstruck to know that Michael Chabon lives just a few blocks away from me. I haven't met him, but if I can help him earn a few royalties because humanists run out to buy his book, I won't complain. It's a wonderful, wonderful novel, and if people enjoy it, they can write to me at Sweet Reason. Bye.
Hey, this is Brett from Connecticut. Heard the podcast regarding religion and superheroes. Pretty fun, pretty cool. Hate to collect comic books. I'm wondering why Batman wasn't mentioned. Wouldn't he be a perfect humanist? Sort of scientific, clever, independent kind of guy. Without superpowers. Did it all on his own. So, kudos to Batman. Even if it's after the fact. Thanks.
Thanks, Brett. Actually, though, we did speak about Batman briefly in that interview. So if you want to find the exact spot where we mentioned the Caped Crusader, just use the Podzinger search box on our podcast blog page at ihslibsyn.com. That search box will actually take you to the spot in the audio program where we talk about Batman. But you're right, Batman totally rocks, especially the Adam West leotard-wearing version of Batman.
Thwack!
Zap zing.
So if you'd like to leave us comments, you can Skype us at hnn_editor, or you can call our listener and comment line at 206-339-4168.
By the way, we didn't get any Skype messages last month, but if you maybe you tried and it didn't work. So if that's the case, please email us at editor@humaniststudies.org. We'll see what the problem is. One of the goals of the Institute for Humanist Studies is to foster collaboration among the free thought community, which is why I'm really excited about this next segment. A few weeks ago, Margaret Downey visited the Humanist Center here in Albany, New York, and spoke with Matt Cherry, our executive director. Margaret Downey recently succeeded Bobby Kirkhart as president of the Atheist Alliance International. For those of you who follow the goings-on in the free thought movement,
which you could do by listening to the Humanist Network News or by reading the e-zine.
Excellent plug.
Thank you.
If you do that, then you know that some of the atheist and humanist organizations out there have somewhat frosty relationships with each other. I'm not trying to downplay any of these conflicts, but, you know, to be honest, from a third-party perspective, it kind of reminds me of sort of sectarian rivalries like Protestant versus Catholic. We have two major atheist organizations based in the United States, the Atheist Alliance International and the American Atheists. They both host their annual conferences on Easter at the same time, which doesn't really foster collaboration because it means you have to choose one or the other. If you're a member of one organization or the other, or actually if you're a member of both, you can't go to both conferences.
And they're usually located on opposite sides of the country.
Yeah, right. So they're definitely impossible. One will be in California, one will be, you know, on the East Coast. So Margaret's going to explain how this situation came about and what she plans to do about it. But I'll give you a little bit of background about the organizations. Madeline Murray O'Hare founded the American Atheists. And among her accomplishments, O'Hare was the one responsible for having prayer removed from American public schools. But in the early 90s, O'Hare dissolved the local chapters of the American Atheists, and those groups banded together, basically, to form the Atheist Alliance, later the Atheist Alliance International. Here's Matt and Margaret.
the American Atheist stopped doing their conference for a few years on Easter weekend, and the Atheist Alliance picked that particular weekend up to fill the void. Well, then American Atheist got reorganized, and I think Ellen Johnson is a fabulous organizer. I just adore her. We're good friends, and she is conducting American Atheist conferences on that same Easter weekend. Well, I think we've come to a point where we now realize that divided in this way, we will never become a viable mass group, a massive voice that will be heard by everyone if we continue to have conferences that conflict with each other. So American Atheist offers to their membership something very different than what we offer. Mm-hmm. And I would like to make that available, what we offer available to even the American Atheist chapters. So I have proposed in the Atheist Alliance internet conversation that we consider an alternative date, and that the time has come for us to realize that we need to be more united in our efforts to reach other atheists, and changing our date would be a goodwill gesture. So as a democratic organization, I have started the conversation. The conversation will develop into a motion. The motion will be voted upon by our member groups, and we will, as a democratic organization, come to some conclusion, and at that point, we will make the announcement. And you know, personally, as a bridge builder and as a networker, I strongly favor an alternative conference date.
Well, I think it's wonderful that you've started that ball rolling. I can see the difficulty of it, because the way you describe it, both organizations had their own reasons for using that weekend, and they both used it when the other one wasn't holding conferences. So I can see that both organizations may feel a sense of ownership over that weekend, and they never set out to be competing with each other.
Exactly.
So I can see how it's difficult for one group to change weekends, because they all see themselves as somehow backing down or conceding something.
Right.
And you end up in a situation where really both groups are suffering because they're losing conference attendees who have to choose between one or the other.
Yes, and speakers, wonderful leaders that have to make a choice as well. So, you know, I want to bring leaders. I would love for Ellen to come to one of our meetings. Ellen Johnson, the president of American Atheist. I would welcome her with open arms to come and speak. And I'm sure she would do the same for me. So, you know, what we need to do is reach out and make sure that all of us are working in unison to fight bigotry against atheists, and to continue our work to maintain the wall of separation of church and state. And we can do that better if we're friendly with each other and we have goodwill between each other. And we're so small. You know, it's just such a small group of people that we're talking about. We're talking about maybe, 5,000 people that, yeah, you know, can possibly come together on one weekend. And wouldn't that be marvelous to have a banquet one day that's, you know, 3,000 to 5,000 people?
Right.
I mean, the Christian Coalition did it recently. Yeah. So
and the presidential candidates can come and tell us why atheists should vote for them.
Exactly. You know, one of the things that I'm going to do as president of the Atheist Alliance International is to reach out to people such as Buffett and Ted Turner and the people that we know, Bill Gates, we right. know how they feel about organized religion. Have they ever been approached by an atheist? Could I get that door opened? Could I get funding from them? Could I get them to actually endorse us and, you know, be more in tune with what our goals are?
That would be wonderful.
Yes.
Well, I look forward to hearing of all the developments at the Atheist Alliance with you as president. I assure our listeners that Humanist Network News will publicize all of these developments, and we're always eager to let our listeners know what's going on in the broader free thought movement. Thank you so much for coming to the Humanist Center, Margaret.
Thank you so much, Matt. It was great to see you.
It's always wonderful to see you.
That was Margaret Downey, new president of the Atheist Alliance International, speaking with Matt Cherry, executive director of the Institute for Humanist Studies.
So there you have it, folks. The atheist Cold War may be coming to an end.
Perhaps. In addition to her role as president of AAI, Margaret Downey is the founder of the Freethought Society of Greater Philadelphia and the Atheist Anti-Discrimination Support Network. Now, she has a long record of advocacy in civil rights litigation, most notably her position to her opposition to the government support for the Boy Scouts of America due to its discrimination against atheists and gays from membership.
Matt and Margaret spoke about a lot of things during the interview, and we're going to be sharing some more of that interview in future podcasts. For more information about the Atheist Alliance International, visit atheistalliance.org. Margaret also wanted to let listeners know, she was emphatic in asking us to let them know that they can feel free to call the Atheist Alliance International anytime at 1-866-HERETIC. Also, I should mention the Atheist Alliance International is a member of the Secular Coalition for America, a national free thought lobbying organization in Washington, D.C., that the Institute for Humanist Studies helped to found.
So it's almost September, and that means that the application for the deadline for the IHS grant fund is approaching.
Mm-hmm. And what's that, Jess?
Well, the Institute for Humanist Studies, through this IHS grant fund, awards more than $100,000 in grants per year to humanist, atheist, and free thought groups around the world. This year's deadline is September 8th. And in order to receive a grant from the Institute, your organization must be registered as a nonprofit. For guidelines and information, you can visit our website at www.humaniststudies.org and click on the link in our sidebar there that says IHS Grant Fund. The Grant Fund will consider all proposals that have advanced humanist principles, but a priority will be given to proposals that reflect the IHS goals of innovation and collaboration. And projects dealing with youth are also especially welcomed.
That's an excellent segue for our next segment in this podcast. IHEO is the International Humanist and Ethical Youth Organization. This is an umbrella organization for humanist and freethought youth organizations throughout the world. Over the past 5 years, the IHS Grant Fund has awarded $60,000 to IHEO. These grants were used to host conferences, hire staff members, and cover general operating expenses. This July, IHEO coordinated an international training seminar for humanist youth workers, and the conference was held in Brussels, where the International Humanist and Ethical Youth Organization is based. Gaia Myers, executive director of IHEO, gave me the chance to send over some questions for these international youth workers, and that I thought our listeners might enjoy hearing the answers to. So here we go.
We are here in Brussels, Belgium, for the experience-based course Humanist Youth Work. And we have four countries represented. Maybe Marit can start.
Okay, my name is Marit. I'm here on behalf of the Norwegian Humanist Association.
Hi, I'm Niklas from Finland, from the Prometheus Camp Association.
My name is Maciej. I'm from Poland. I'm a member of Polish Rationalist Association.
I'm Sarah from Belgium, and I'm a board member of Humanist Youngsters.
When I say the word humanism, what do you think about? Can I get one word from each of you?
No dogma.
Feeling connected.
The value of the human individual.
Human rights.
Democracy.
Can anyone answer to the question, how did you come to find humanism as life stance?
If I can try to answer this question, it's personal as for me. But when I was a child, I had been sent to church by my family, but I completely wasn't interested in this, in being in the church. It wasn't funny, there wasn't any friends, And as for me, it was wasting a time. So after some time, when I was maybe 9 or 9, 10, I said, I'm not going to go there anymore because I don't know why I should to. And then my mother told me, you should to because everyone are doing this.
You felt forced.
Yes, but I was strong enough to say, okay, but I am not everyone, and I don't care this, and I have my opinion, my autonomy, I have only one life, and if I am not interested, I will not do it. And it was my finish of my life as a child, and I started... it was starting for me to be a humanist, but I also then was thunk about this very long time. If the churches and the popes and the Pope don't want to allow people who are in love to have love, it's not something ethically wrong, ethically correct.
Anyone else wants to say anything?
Yeah, I would like to say that I didn't choose to be a humanist. I just ended up as one because of many reasons. I have been raised in a home where humanistic values were obvious part of everyday life, thanks to my parents, and so I learned basics quite young, although I didn't understand the larger picture behind them. But when I grew older, I also understood why my doings are right and how to argue for their righteousness. I have never doubted that humanism wouldn't be the way to go, but I don't think that is because I was raised to believe in it. I made a lot of thinking during my teenager years and thought a lot about humanism and explored other possibilities, but in the end, I came into the conclusion that humanism is the best life stance for me. This was the short version why and how I ended up as a humanist.
Thank you. What in your lives make meaning to you?
Freedom for everybody.
The fact that we only have this one life and we have to make the best of it.
Self-fulfillment and doing this what you want to do and what will make you happy.
Making the world a better place to live for everyone.
Being tolerant and accepting people like they are.
Okay, thank you. What are the major areas of focus that every humanist group throughout the world should focus on?
Well, I think an important focus for all members of humanist organizations in the world and all associations as well is the human rights. I think that's really important for everyone. I think that's the basic thing in our life stance. And I also think that ethical action should be the main goal of our work, on not only in our organizations, but also in our lives.
Okay, Marit, you said ethical actions. Does anyone here have an example to ethical action?
Well, the thing about ethics is that you are a human being, you are an individual, but you are also living with other human beings. So you have to make a way to make this cooperation work. And you have the golden rule of ethics that has been known for several thousand years, that you should do unto others as you want them to do to you. And this is something that isn't really something that is handed to us by philosophers or gods or something. I mean, this is something that I, as a modern human being, I can use my senses, I can look around me, I can see the reactions of other people, and I can acknowledge that this is a good principle, that by and large, other people have the same feelings, the same reactions as I would.
Does any of you have an idea on how humanist groups should engage youth or youngsters?
Well, I think that the main thing is that because we are humanists, we shouldn't just go and tell that, well, this is a really good thing. We believe in critical thinking, and it should come from the youngsters themselves. We can just give them the information and have, like, informations about humanism to youth houses or youth information points, go to schools and talk it in the media. But I think that the main point is that youngsters have the information and then they can choose by themselves what they want to believe and what kind of life stance they want.
Okay. I will do a follow-up to that question concerning critical thinking. Do you think that the United States is exporting religious extremism?
Well, as a European, I see that in the US there's a problem with the black and white thinking, that because reality is not black or white, it's something in between.
And I also think you could say the Americans are like not the best example for being or respecting the Human Declaration of Rights, not only in their external politics, but also in the way things are going in the country itself.
I think why it is so hard for me to understand what America is doing is that to me it seems that they are doing a lot of counterproductive things. As a humanist, I like to base the decisions that are made on the knowledge we have. And there are so many sciences like psychology, sociology, lots of other sciences, that conflict resolution theories, that tells us that what America has been doing lately is really counterproductive to what they say they want to achieve. So I think this is a great paradox that such a nation with such they are so scientifically ahead of other countries in many cases, and they do these counterproductive things according to theories.
If, as we know now, all of us probably American president Mr. Bush is very religious person. And his decision are made under the religious thinking, and some of his decisions had been he said that he made because God wanted this. That's really a big problem, not only for Islamic countries, but also for the Americans, that they now have the president who is not doing what the nation want, but what the God want.
The latest years since like the most important terrorist attacks, it's like the idea is going around that Muslims are more fundamentalist, and you should weapon yourselves against those people. And in America they have now like an evolution, people become more and more religious again.
Actually, when it comes to the role of the United States in our world today, I would encourage the people listening to go to the www.ihu.org page, because the current and all former Secretaries General of the Norwegian Humanist Association has made a statement there where they say that America was very big at almost inventing human rights in the 18th century, but that Norwegian humanists are very concerned about what's happening now.
As you are different organizations, in what way do you do activities to reach the youngsters?
Autonomy and mutual respect for everyone's identity are very central to our organization, and we also have high thinking of the principle of free inquiry.
So in Norway we support everything that the Belgian Sarah just said. I think the motivation of the youngsters is there, because what we're dealing with are the big philosophical questions like what is good, what is true, what is beauty, these things that people actually have been wondering about for several thousand years. So everybody is interested. So the difficulty then is to sort of get them to come to our activities. And then we need to apply the principles that Sarah talked about with the autonomy, with the free inquiry and these things.
In Finland, we focus on doing the summer camps and talking the ethical things with the youth and the similar stuff that they all said already. And also we train to leaders. And
you train leaders?
Yes, and we have this...
to be better leaders.
Yes, in humanistic way.
I think I would like to add just one more thing. For us, humanism is an attitude for people who are in love with life. So we want that to be seen in the organization as well, that life can be fun. You have responsibility in life, but life is something great to experience, and we cannot forget that.
Thank you, Sarah. To close the circle, I would ask you one last question now. Can you say three positive things about this camp?
Well, I think the main point that I have learned in here is learned loads about different cultures and how they do things and how they see humanism. I think that was the main point for me.
I think for me it broadens your perspective, so you learn to see things from new points of view.
I completely agree. I can add, we as Poles have many benefits from being in here, and we hope we can establish a regular contact between our organization, because we want to be part of European movement, humanist movement.
Thing that really stuck with me was to experience how much the cultures that that are here really do have differences. It was not like I expected. I expected it to be a more like a more similarities in the culture. So I was kind of surprised, but I liked it.
And I think it's very, very inspiring to get to learn all these nice people doing fantastic things with youths in their country. Based upon the respect for the individual youth, and that this youth has abilities, has possibilities, has a lot of good things that we can experience together.
Thank you very much for coming to the studio. Have a nice day.
That was a special presentation by the International Humanist and Ethical Youth Organization, otherwise known as IHEO. Jess, how many times fast can you say IHEO?
IHEO, not even once, Duncan.
See, and I've said it about seven times. Special thanks to Lisbeth Mines of the Young Humanists of Belgium for coordinating this presentation, and thanks for Siri for moderating that discussion. She's definitely a natural. We should get her in the studio here. That was actually an edited down version of this presentation, so if you want to hear the full audio segment, just check out our blog page for HNN, which is ihs.libsyn.com, and I put a link there.
All right. Well, that's all the time that we have for today, folks. You've been listening to the Humanist Network News podcast. I'm your host, Jess Constantine.
And I'm your host, Duncan Crary.
Humanist Network News is a monthly podcast and weekly e-zine. Transcripts of our shows appear online at humanistnetworknews.org 1 month after they air. And now for a list of all the songs that you've heard throughout our podcast, you can look at our podcast blog page that Duncan just mentioned, ihs.libsyn.com.
The weekly Humanist Network News e-zine is available online at humanistnetworknews.org. Use of our theme music was generously donated to the Institute for Humanist Studies by singer-songwriter Holly Near. HollyNear.com.
To leave us a listener comment, you can call 206-339-4168, or you can Skype us from anywhere in the world. Our Skype name is HNN_editor.
Thanks for listening.
Peace out.
ain't afraid of your prey, and I'm afraid of what you're doing.